Welcome back, I'm Erin. In this episode, Ethan and I go over the 911 call transcripts that were released as a result of a public right-to-know request filed earlier this year. We also talk about the photos of Maura's dorm room that were displayed at CrimeCon, as well as briefly discussing an institution in New Hampshire known as the Lori List. I want to mention one note before we start, which is that in the episode, we discuss another part of John Monahan's interview from The Oxygen Show. I filed a records request for the transcript of his interview with the Cold Case Unit several months ago, and barring any unforeseen issues or challenges, I should be able to release the redacted version that they provide very soon, hopefully within the next week or so. So as always, feel free to reach out to us with any questions, comments, or clarifications. So, do you want to go over the 911 calls in some detail?
Yeah.
So, all right. First, I'm going to explain how they were obtained.
Yes. Good idea.
So, the 911 call transcripts were obtained via a public right-to-know request that happened to coincide with CrimeCon, but had nothing to do with CrimeCon. Mm-hmm. It was sent back in February, and we just got them back in May.
Right. So, it took... How many months is that? 3 months for them to respond?
Yeah. And I think part of that was because in New Hampshire, 911 calls are exempt from public disclosure. So the police don't have to give you them.
Right. There's a specific exemption in the law. It's not some broad like, oh, it's related to a case, so it's exempt. It's like, no, the law about 911 says that it's exempt from public disclosure. So it's 100% exempt in every case.
Mm-hmm. Yes. They can choose to disclose them if they want to, but they don't have to.
Yeah.
And in this case, I think there was some ambiguity because Atwood's call in particular was, he called 911, but it was routed to Hanover. So there was a question about, well, is that still a 911 call or is it a local county dispatcher call?
Right. So it took them some time to come up with a definitive legal answer mm-hmm. as to whether they had to give you the call or whether the call was subject to, what's the name of the law?
It's the right to know law in New Hampshire, which is the state equivalent of the Federal Freedom of Information Act.
Yes. And it follows roughly the Freedom of Information Act in terms of like description and how it's written.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So what I was able to learn, like sort of during the back and forth of our communications about the calls, was that there were three calls between, I guess what I'll call the public and dispatchers regarding Maura's accident. So two of them were released. The first one was Faith Westman's call, and the second one was Butch Atwood's call. The third is the call back from dispatch to Barbara Atwood. That one is still not being released.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to get clarification on why that's the case.
Right.
Because the original answer that they gave me was that it wasn't subject to disclosure because it was a purely 911 emergency communication.
Right.
But I'm not sure if that's accurate.
Yeah, that doesn't seem accurate, right?
Right. Again, the specific statute that they cited was RSA 106H:14, which is sort of the overall general exemption for 911 calls from disclosure.
Right. And that's that law, the broader law, is the 911 law.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they made a mistake.
And it's possible. So let's go over Faith Westman's call.
Sure.
All right. So the timestamp on Westman's call was 7:27 p.m., as we pretty much knew. And the length of the call was 1:18. So this one, unlike Atwood's, went directly to Grafton County. So there really isn't anything in here that we didn't already assume that Westman told dispatch.
Right.
Of course, there's two lines, complete lines, that are redacted.
Yes. So what I've tried to do with these lines is sort of infer what they might have been about based on the conversation that occurred around them. So like what would naturally be occurring in that space. So the first one is pretty early in the conversation. It's actually the third thing that Faith says. They asked if anyone was hurt. She says, I've not gone out to investigate. They say, okay, kind of cutting her off a little bit. And then she says something else. And then the dispatcher immediately follows up with, are you in, you're in Bath, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So that could imply they're talking about the location.
Yeah, or it's the comment about the man in the vehicle smoking a cigarette.
Right, because it is after she asked about if anyone was hurt by Rhonda Marsh, who was asked about the occupants of the car, in a sense. So that would be a place where you might state that, I haven't gone out to investigate, okay, but I can see a man in the car smoking a cigarette.
Yeah, that's what I sort of thought might be there.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, going a little bit further down, the next sentence that's redacted, it's in the context of the dispatcher asking, okay, or saying, okay, I'll be sending an officer. And Faith Westman says, okay, around the corner from the barn. So after the barn? Yeah. So that there, it looks like they're describing location.
Yeah.
So to me, it would make sense if the location information was there.
Yeah. And we know that in the logs, Rhonda Marsh says that she gives a very specific description from the caller of the way the car was. She said it was in the, in the westbound lane facing west?
Yeah, was in eastbound, but ended up in westbound ditch facing westbound.
Right. And if you look at Faith Westman's, it's like three lines that are redacted. That kind of makes sense. It's kind of complicated to explain, because I doubt she said westbound or eastbound. So that might take a lot of words, because it's kind of hard to describe.
Yeah. And so, and correct me if I'm wrong, my logic is off here, but I think those have to be the two things that are redacted, because we know that they were communicated because they're in the dispatch log and they're not anywhere else in the transcript. And the call was only a minute and 18 seconds. And as far as we know, there wasn't any other communication with Faith Westman.
Correct. It's almost like there's no other way to read it. The only possibility is that both of those are in the later redaction, and that the man smoking the cigarette and the direction of the car, and that the first redaction is something else. That's the only other possibility I see where there could be additional information, but it seems more likely that both those two separate pieces of information are the two redactions.
Yeah.
There are other redactions we should just briefly mention. They're specifically location and phone numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clear that they are, because one of them is, and your phone number, and then redaction, and then, and your address is redaction. And then the other one is the 911 dispatcher saying, this is 911, I show it as, and then redaction, which is going to be a location.
Mm-hmm.
All the redactions are addresses, or the personal information, addresses and phone numbers, or gigantic entire sentences.
Right. And I should read the disclaimer that was connected to these calls. I should have done it earlier. So this is the disclaimer that was attached to the call transcripts. As you'll see in the transcripts, information has been redacted that would constitute an invasion of privacy if released per RSA 91A:5, 4, as well as information compiled for law enforcement purposes whose disclosure could reasonably be expected to interfere with law enforcement proceedings.
Yeah.
So I think that it's really easy to read into that a little bit and say, well, because these two sections were redacted, it must mean that they have something to do or could have something to do with a future law enforcement proceeding. Basically, that they're relevant in some way to the investigation.
Yeah.
It's possible, but I think that it's not Detective West who is choosing what to redact and what not to redact.
Okay.
He advises the lawyer who ultimately decides what he's going to choose to consider possibly relevant to an investigation. And he doesn't know all of the particulars about this specific case. And so I have to assume that he's probably going to be a little bit more on the conservative side.
Mm-hmm, right. So let's get specific about it, because we're pretty sure we know what these details are. So regarding the man smoking the cigarette, for all the lawyer knows, that man smoking a cigarette is like a suspect in the case. Or the fact that there's a man smoking a cigarette, or that there might be a man smoking a cigarette, is like very pertinent to the case. We would say, having been immersed in this case, it's probably not, because it probably wasn't a man smoking a cigarette. It was probably just a mistaken impression, and it was just probably more, to us, that's not worthy of redaction, but you're saying he wouldn't necessarily know that.
Right. And like I said, he does consult, I'm sure, with Detective West and with people that do have a lot of knowledge about the case.
Mm-hmm.
But under no circumstance are they ever going to say, you should disclose more.
Right. Yes. If he says, I redacted this, is that okay? They're always going to say, yeah, sure. Because as I recall, you said, I don't know if we want to put this in the episode or not, but you said that West, the cold case detective, said that his position was that the calls shouldn't be released at all, that they were 911 calls and that they were exempt, and he was overruled by the attorneys. He's not a guy who's going to tell someone that they don't need to redact something from these calls that he thought should not be released in the first place.
Yeah.
So certainly, yes, if it was improperly redacted or if it was redacted as being pertinent to the case, it actually wasn't, that wouldn't get fixed. No one's going to fix that.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, so we talked about the man smoking a cigarette. My theory on the other one, you know, the specific location of the car, that's getting into like, assuming that she was trying to very like accurately describe how the car was positioned, again, yeah, the lawyer might not know. Maybe that's extremely relevant to the case. In fact, these are the longest things that Faith says. These are the two longest bunches of words. So it could just be that he's like, well, it looks like there's a lot of details here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of specific stuff here that might be important, so let's take it out. So it's really hard to infer anything from it. And what's really interesting is we already know that information because we know it from the logs. So it's really hard to imagine it as like any kind of like holdback or something like that, because it's like, well, the man smoking a cigarette comment is already out there. The position of the car is already out there. So yeah, I don't actually see this information as like, oh, there's stuff under these redactions that we could really use. It would be nice to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's unlikely there's anything big there.
Right. And I would just say like, operate under the assumption that they're going to be very conservative about what gets redacted and what doesn't.
Yeah.
If it could possibly, even just possibly, be used or part of an investigation.
The incentive is to redact more.
Yeah. So that was Faith Westman's call. I think Atwood's call is a little bit more interesting.
Yes.
And so again, he called 911 and couldn't get through to Grafton County. So he spoke to the 911 dispatcher who routed his call to Hanover. So that's why his call was approximately 3 minutes, which is about twice as long as Faith Westman's, but it's about the same length.
Yeah, roughly the same number of words.
Mm-hmm. So whatever he said to the 911 dispatcher, we actually do not have the transcript of that.
But it was probably pretty mundane.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that there was a question about whether this was Atwood's call to 911 or whether it was the call back from dispatchers. And it was the call to 911, again, that was routed to Hanover. And this is the Hanover portion of their conversation. And just to give the timestamp of the call, Atwood called 911 at 7:42.
This is a 3-minute call, so at this point, it's probably 7:43.
Yes, and in the dispatch log, it says at 7:43. So we can safely assume, I think, that Hanover received the call at 7:43.
Yeah, they picked up the phone at 7:43, and that's what they told Haverhill and said, hey, we got a call at 7:43. Here's the information, probably.
Right.
And that lines up.
Okay, so just to recap, Atwood calls 911 at 7:42. 911 essentially transfers the call to Hanover dispatch at 7:43. The entire length of the call is 3 minutes, so approximately from 7:42 to 7:45.
Yeah. So let's go through it.
I mean, I think the first thing that jumps out when you read Atwood's transcript is that he says he hit a pine tree.
Hmm. Yes. Well, the first thing that jumps out to me is he says, good evening, is this Grafton County? So he's not even aware that he's been given Hanover.
Yeah.
But then, yes, he says his name, and he says where he is, which is redacted, the road he's on. And this is weird to me, because they redact the road name and the town, but then he says, up by the weathered barn. Well, we know exactly where he is based on the weathered barn. Like, why wouldn't you have redacted weather? Like, but then it gets into like, well, it's ridiculous because we all know where this guy lives. We all know where Faith Westman lives. Like, this is not a secret. Like, why are you bothering to redact it? But
yeah, but again, I think it goes back to them, you know, applying the letter of the law.
Yes. It's very easy to redact every road, every town name, every street number, every phone number.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So he says single car motor vehicle accident. So he says there's one car. So there's really no room for there to be another car at the time that Butch Atwood saw it. And then, yeah, he hit a pine tree. Airbag is deployed.
Mm-hmm. So there's actually kind of a lot of information in this little snippet. The fact that he says he hit a pine tree, I do think that that was probably either a misstatement or like a function of the transcription.
Yeah, because we know he said he spoke to a girl.
Yeah, later on he says a single female.
He's using the generic he, the unisex he, I think, in that case.
It also could just be, because we didn't hear it, it could be, it just sounds like he, and the transcriber is going to transcribe exactly what it sounds like, not necessarily what they think it sounds
she
like.
She and he are actually pretty similar. If there's any distortion at all at the beginning of the word she, all you get is the e part, and you could definitely read it as he. So that's, I agree, that's probably nothing.
The second thing he says is about the pine tree, which I do find really interesting, because Monahan also mentioned in his narrative statement that the driver hit a tree.
He did. Now, he could have been going from what he heard on the radio, because we know that he was listening to chatter on the radio about information that was coming in via the phone. So he might have heard from Atwood that the driver hit a pine tree or hit a tree. But again, it's dark. He's probably not inspecting too carefully. He doesn't see any vehicles around that she could have hit, so he's going to assume.
It looks like it could possibly be a tree hit.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it doesn't look like it could at all possibly be a tree, but to the untrained eye, someone not really thinking about it in any way whatsoever, just that they see damage, you're going to assume probably is a tree. Because, like, what the hell else would someone hit?
Mm-hmm.
You hit a snowbank, it's going to destroy the snowbank. The car might get stuck. It's not going to usually destroy the front of your car hitting a snowbank. So you're probably going to assume tree.
Right. Yeah, I would really like to get the accident photos for this reason. Side note, they are not releasing them at this time, citing that they are investigatory in nature. Right.
Yeah, and just to reiterate, I mean, I think we've talked about this, you know, having been up there, I do not see how she could have possibly hit a pine tree or a tree at all. They're far off the road. There would have been a snowbank. And then to hit the tree and get back onto the road.
Not only that, but the damage. So if she had hit a tree, you would have seen like a sort of like uniform.
Yeah, vertically, the damage would be consistent. There wouldn't be more damage on the top of the car versus on the lower. Yeah, I don't see how a tree could possibly do that damage.
Yeah, and just also for the record, the New Hampshire League of Investigators that utilized an accident reconstructionist also came to the conclusion that she did not hit a tree. Healy was quoted in the Caledonian Record saying that Healy said, although police have said Murray crashed her car into the trees, he and other investigators do not believe it to be true. He said, based on the damage to the Saturn, that it appears as if the car was traveling at a slow speed when it may have struck the underside of another vehicle. The actual crash site may have taken place somewhere else. So they, I believe, uniformly agreed that it probably didn't hit a tree.
Yeah, I have to agree. Other than the statement of it being a pine tree, which I think could very clearly have been an assumption based on the fact that no other vehicles were present, it looks nothing like a tree. It looks like she hit something higher, something above the height of her car.
And on the left side of the road.
And on the left side to boot, which even more suggests not a tree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean that there was no real accident at the weather barred corner? I don't think so, because she definitely could have gotten into an accident prior and got back on the road and then spun out on the weather barred corner. So just because the damage isn't consistent hitting the tree doesn't mean that the accident occurred somewhere else and then was like moved or staged at the weather barred corner. To me, it's very possible that she had two accidents. In fact, we pretty much know the car was in running condition because the reason that she wasn't able to start it was that the steering was locked.
We think.
Well, it was stated that she attempted to start the car several times, right? But she couldn't because the steering was locked. Which to me implies that the person who made that statement, which I think was
Art,
to me that implies that the car could have been started.
Yeah. Also, Mr. Murray started up the car later that week when he went to see it. So he was able to start the car.
Ah, well, there you go. So that would mean if she had a prior accident, yeah, the car was in running condition. The car was certainly in running condition with the damage that it had. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that she had an earlier accident and simply drove away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And then she wipes out on the weather bar corner. Again, any explanation that has her wiping out on the weather bar corner as like a coincidence, like coincidental to the thing that she impacted, to me is just unlikely. The more likely explanation is it's a sharp corner. She lost control going too fast around a sharp corner.
Right. And I mean, I think that Atwood actually speaks to that in his call He says she's shaken up. No blood that I see, but the airbag was deployed. Heavy damage. It's right on the bad corner near the weathered barn. So
it was in a bad corner.
And I remember Witness A actually described a time when she saw another accident there at some point later, a little bit further east. And she actually, I can't remember if she got in an accident there as well at some point or somewhere. Anyway, it's a bad corner.
Yeah. Well, and we've seen it, and it's definitely a bad corner, especially because if you're driving 40, it would be very easy to not slow down fast enough. It's also like a long turn. Like it just keeps turning. So I could see it as, you know, it's just she didn't slow down enough. And then the car skidded at that point. The steering locked. Car skidded, spun around. Yeah, definitely possible.
Right.
Unfortunately, we can't get that out of this because he says she hit pine trees, but it just brings up the question of what did she hit? And one other thing I think is interesting here, and it's what's interesting to me is what is not the case about this transcript, which is that the very long section where he talks about she's shaken up, no blood, airbag deployed, describing the location, that is not redacted. And earlier we were talking about Faith Westman's call and the possibility, you know, maybe they're just overzealous with the redaction and they're redacting anything that they think might be important. Well, by that same logic, I would think that section would have been redacted because it seems to be of similar, it's a similar sort of description, right? He's talking about what he saw at the scene and the specific location, which was presumably one of the sections redacted on Faith Westman's call, which he's talking about the position of the vehicle. And yet, in her case, it was entirely redacted here. That whole section of Butch Atwood's call is not.
Yeah, I agree. I think the one thing I would say, though, is that Atwood is describing, he's describing the same location. He's using a lot of words to basically say at the weathered barn corner.
Yes, that's true. He doesn't specify the orientation of the car, for example.
Right. Whereas Westman.
But he does say he sees the airbag deployed. He does say damage. He does say no blood. If I was being very cautious with redaction, I would have thought I maybe would have redacted that, especially the part about the airbag being deployed.
That's really interesting. You're right.
It might be nothing, you know, it could be if I was to see what Faith Westman said, I might more see something there that would be worthy of an overly cautious redaction. I don't know. Just kind of interesting because, you know, some of the logic I used in explaining Faith's redactions was that, well, those were the longest segments. So there's a lot of details there, but we've got that section and an earlier sentence by Butch Atwood, which was also three lines, which did not get the same treatment, Faith. So you can't apply a simple rule of whenever there's a lot of stuff being said, they redact. That certainly was not the logic used in the redaction, assuming the same person does these redactions.
Yeah. Well, either way, it was the same lawyer who signed off on it. So the other thing about Atwood's call is the timestamp that they have for when he called into 911 and what it says or what it can inform about the timeline. Because Detective West confirmed that he called 911 at 7:42. Again, it looks like he was transferred to Hanover at 7:43. And the call presumably ended around 7:45. I had always assumed that the 7:43 timestamp was actually dispatch calling back Barbara Atwood.
Ah.
But it seems as though that didn't happen until some point later. So probably the next couple of minutes. I think that she logged that call or that narrative at 7:48. So she probably called back pretty soon after, you know, 7:46, 7:47, something like that.
Yep.
So if Atwood was calling 911 at 7:42, he, at that point, had no reason to believe that police were already there.
Right, because he doesn't mention that. He wouldn't have called if police were already there, presumably.
Right. Now, is it possible that he called and didn't know that police were there? I guess.
It is possible. However, we know that the crash site is visible from there, so it would be easy enough for him to check or to be looking kind of at the scene as he makes the call. That doesn't mean he did necessarily.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then also, I'm looking at the Caledonian Record from February 20th.
Okay.
Where he is quoted as saying, it says, while he was talking on his phone on his front porch, Atwood could see the road, but not Moore's disabled car. He saw several vehicles drive by, but couldn't tell any of the makes or models because it was so dark. After about 7 to 9 minutes, he looked out and saw the Haverhill police.
Ah, interesting. So Yeah, to me that suggests while he's on the phone, there are no police there, because he would definitely see the blue lights reflecting off the trees and stuff in the area. If he can see the road, he's on his porch, he can see cars, he's going to see those lights. And we know, or we think we know, based on Monahan's transcripts, that he heard some chatter regarding someone saying they saw blue lights, which we think might have been Barbara, which implies that you can see the blue lights, you could see the police lights from the house. Based on what you just said about the Caledonian Record and him being on his porch, him saying that he was on his porch, that when he made the call, the police were not there. I feel comfortable saying he would have known based on that, based on being on his porch.
Yeah, assuming that's true. Of course, it's always possible that he was just wrong.
He might have misremembered, or maybe he started out on his porch, but then he walked inside.
Mm-hmm. But that still would start at 7:42, though.
That would be starting at 7:42. That's true, if that was the case. So he'd pretty much have to be completely wrong in order for the police to have been there at 7:42. He would just have to be totally wrong about having been on his porch, I think. Or the police didn't have their lights on. Smith showed up and didn't have his lights on, which I find impossible to believe because that is just straight up dangerous. So yeah, if his lights are on and if Butch Atwood's on the porch when he initiates that phone call, there is no police car there at that time.
Right. And then again, what did Monahan see? So at two different points in Monahan's interview, he notes the conversation that occurred between dispatch and somebody who is informing them about what they saw at the scene. So Monahan says, "While I was headed there, I heard Cecil Smith call off that he'd arrived on the scene. And so I continued on because I heard there was also like a play-by-play that dispatch was telling him as we were both going to the area. And I could overhear Grafton County talking to him. And it was the caller saying, 'Well, I don't see her anymore. They initially, I believe, said there's a woman by the car. And then I think they said she's not there anymore.' Or when Cecil got there, I don't really recall that part, said she's not here anymore." And then later on in the interview, Art asks, I know a lot of times SOP, standard operating procedure, for 911 calls is the standard procedures. You would keep the individual on the line until a unit either showed up on scene or came to the door. Was that what was occurring here?" John's response was, "I think they did because I believe it would have been a conversation. There's a White House on the corner, and I believe that was the caller. And so it was a conversation between them and whoever the dispatcher was that evening. And so I do believe that, and I don't know for sure, but I believe I remember them hearing the officers here. You know, they could see the blue lights or something to that effect. But I do remember there was a brief snippet of a conversation that occurred. They could see his blue lights, or they relayed some sort of information to Smith when he arrived." So there's a lot of uncertainty in his voice, it seems. There's a lot of hedging. Uh-huh. It seems like Monahan is a hedger.
Yes.
Pretty much everything he says, because he's an officer and he knows how bad witness statements are, probably.
Probably, yeah.
But one of the things he seems pretty sure of is, "I do remember there was a brief snippet of a conversation. They could see his blue lights, or they relayed some information to Smith when he arrived."
Yeah, he mentioned the blue lights twice. He hedges a lot, but he says that twice. So that, to me, means that he's specifically remembering the caller mentioning the blue lights.
Yep. Now, he sort of assumes that this was Westman communicating this information.
Right, but he wouldn't really know, necessarily.
Yeah. And his prior statement about them initially saying that there was a woman by the car, but then she's not there anymore, this seems to line up or correspond exactly to what's in the dispatch log about dispatch's call with Barbara Atwood when they called her back.
Right. They say in the narrative on the call with Barbara that she has no idea where the female is. So that indicates they were talking about the girl in the car on Barbara's call. And the police were asking if she knew where she was, which, yeah, like you said, kind of dovetails with Monahan's statement that he overheard that she's not there anymore. So, I mean, it's true that the caller did see blue lights, and it was almost certainly Barbara. She can see blue lights from the house. So it's not like they couldn't have known, you know, that Butch Atwood couldn't have known that the police were there earlier. He absolutely could have, because they saw the blue lights certainly later. So I agree, that does line up.
So that would have been around 7:46, 7.
Right, based on the time of entry of that narrative statement, which was 7:48.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that, I'm trying to picture this happening now, because he's saying that, you know, Smith was in communication with dispatch at the time that they were also getting information. In fact, he said he could hear the caller, so he could hear the woman over the radio. So they're piping the conversation over the radio. So to me, what that means is, and this is a bit of assumption, but it does line up, Smith called in to dispatch saying, hey, there's nobody here. And dispatch either had just called back Barbara or then was prompted to call back Barbara, call back the Atwoods to get more information, because their officer on scene is telling them, hey, there's no one here. And so they wanted to find out, like, hey, did you see her? So that's when they put the call directly into the radio, or close enough to the radio where Smith could hear, so that he could hear directly what the witness was saying about the status from their vantage point. That makes total sense. And to me, what makes the most sense is that it happens right after Smith gets there and looks around the car. 7:46. 7:45, he gets there. 7:46, he's looked around the car. There's no one there. He calls in. 7:47, they're talking to Barbara. Short conversation probably would help to have that call, and then they enter it in the logs after that.
And then he goes over to the Westmans and says, where's the girl?
And then he goes to the Westmans, yeah, and says, where's the girl?
Yeah, I don't think that the 911 call transcripts say anything either way about whether or not there was another officer on scene prior to Smith's arrival.
No.
I mean, to me, this is more evidence that Smith probably arrived around 7:45 or 7:46.
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly say it adds more data points that are consistent with the 7:46 arrival, which is just more data points that you have to explain away to get an earlier arrival time. Doesn't, unfortunately, definitively prove anything, but it certainly matches up very nicely with Cecil Smith arriving around 7:45.
Right. Matches up perfectly, in fact.
Yeah. You know, it's to the point where I'm like, I got to go back myself and look at witness A, Karen McNamara, and say, like, did she really see what she saw, what she said she saw? And is that timestamp that we have on her cell phone call really saying what we think it is? Because, goddamn, it really looks like, if that's all true, there was another police officer on scene. Like, I can't come up with another plausible explanation.
Yeah, I can't either. I do believe, like, it is more likely to me, having all these data points, that witness A is wrong then Smith showed up at 7:35. That's way more likely to me.
Yeah. It's much easier to just say witness A must be wrong.
Yeah. It's possible. But, like, is it a coincidence that she saw an SUV? And they're saying that he was in an SUV? That's pretty coincidental.
Yeah.
If she's wrong. And to have been so consistent about it for so many years, even after being told that she was wrong.
Yeah.
So I guess the one last thing I would say about the 7:42 timestamp, and a question that's from the dispatch log that's sort of been out there for a long time, is why did they wait, you know, 15 minutes or so to dispatch fire and EMS?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they did so at 7:42 and 30 seconds suggests to me that it was a function of the 911 call from Atwood. So that's what I'm going to say almost certainly prompted them to dispatch fire and EMS that time.
Yes. Yeah, I agree, because that's almost too coincidental. We know they weren't dispatched until much later. We know there's a 911 call. We know that that is the first confirmation directly from someone who spoke to a victim who says anything about her health, and specifically says she's shaken up, damaged to the car. So now they know for a fact, because the Westmans didn't go out to the car, that the car is both damaged and the driver is affected in some way, adverse way, by the accident. So that all kind of lines up with that having occurred in that way.
Yeah. And then the last thing I wanted to just go over is the dorm photos, the dorm pictures that they showed at CrimeCon.
Now this comes to us via what?
Via Maggie at CrimeCon from the state police.
Okay.
I believe that is where this information was obtained. And there is a picture of what appears to be clothes and bags. There's a picture of her closet. There's a purse and some jackets, it looks like. There's a picture of her computer and her desk and her stereo, mini fridge, and a monkey hanging from a pipe.
What's that in the photo with the two speakers on the shelf? There's a stack of CDs on the middle shelf, and then there's some paper there. Do we know what that item is, that paper?
That looks like a pay stub to me. I'm not positive. And it looks like it might be perforated. So that's why I thought that it might be a pay stub from work.
I mean, I guess you would know what the pay stubs look like.
I'm not positive that that's what it is, but...
Gotcha.
I mean, I think that people sort of came to the conclusion that these pictures meant that she wasn't packing up her life to leave. Because there's, you know, she still has things hanging and... She didn't take her computer. Her computer is still there.
Yep.
I mean, I didn't think that she was packing up to leave anyway, so.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at this, it's like, the statements about her room being packed up, like, it's not packed up. It doesn't look especially lived in, but then again, it wasn't especially lived in at that time, recently back. You know, I guess the bags of clothes might be what they were referencing, the police were referencing and saying that it was packed.
I believe that they were referring to things that were on her bed, but they don't show the picture
of the bed. Oh, yeah, the picture's not there. Yeah, there were, what, two boxes?
Yeah, I don't know if they said how many, but they said that there were boxes.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see her toiletries next to the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. Like, you know those carry things?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the shower caddy. So she was using that stuff. Yeah, it's not packed.
Yeah, it might be my bias because I didn't believe it was packed to begin with, but I don't think it looks packed. No. So it really, to me, begs the question of why Scorinza came to the conclusion that she had definitely packed up to the point where he made that statement in a press release to the FBI in June of 2004.
Yeah, it's not good.
And just so we're not misstating anything that he said, I'll read exactly what he said in this sure. press release. He says, by Monday morning, February 9th, Maura had packed up all her belongings in her dorm room at UMass, putting everything neatly in boxes and putting all the boxes on her bed along with a personal note she had recently received from her boyfriend.
Wow. All her items. That is clearly not the case.
Right. And, I mean, again, being charitable to Lieutenant Scorinza, perhaps he didn't know that UMass not made you, but they locked up their dorms during intersession. So you essentially do move out and move back in at the beginning and end of every semester. So this is very consistent with somebody who is just moving in for the semester.
Yeah. He might have just simply jumped to the conclusion that, oh, there was some packed stuff, so therefore she was packing up to leave, you know, because it's funny. He doesn't say that she was leaving, right? He just says, oh, all her stuff was packed neatly in boxes and kind of lets you draw your own conclusion. And yet he's letting you draw your own conclusion based on facts that are not facts. Her stuff wasn't all packed. Only some of it was packed.
Right.
He's just trying to paint a very clear picture. And I just really feel that it just seems very defensive. Seems like, get off my back. Look, all her stuff was packed. And maybe someone just told him her stuff was packed and he's just passing it along and didn't really know because he wasn't really paying. Maybe he wasn't. I don't know. Was he like personally running the investigation and paying close attention, or was he, you know, leading?
Yeah, I believe that he was the lead investigator on the case. I mean, that's why he's giving this press release.
See, I thought he was just like in charge of the truth.
It's possible, but he owns these words because he is putting out this statement. So he has to take ownership of them. I mean, if he can't be precise or he can't be accurate about a very simple fact in the case, why do we trust anything he says? He also says that Maura was, she had putting all her things in boxes on her bed along with a personal note she had recently received from her boyfriend. That, right. Of course, referring to the printed email, I believe he said that to imply that she was suicidal and she was leaving some sort of suicide note.
And the police specifically said, Scorinza specifically said, a note from her boyfriend. He didn't say anything about the content of that note.
I mean, that's the beauty of it. It can be whatever you want it to be, because there's actually no information about it.
He left it vague enough that your imagination could run wild, and he probably knew you were going to go to, oh, relationship troubles, and we have literally no idea. Clearly, regarding the packed room, he's stretching the truth. He could very well be stretching the truth about that note as well. And I do think, you know, his statement actually shows his clear bias and does definitely call into question anything that he said to anyone. And unquestionably, Fred saw this statement from Scorinza. So we can say that when he talks about the police wanting to sweep it under the rug, there is actual data to back that up.
I agree.
The line about her being pregnant, that came from Scorinza via Renner.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if Art and Maggie asked Lieutenant Scorinza why he was so sure about her packing up.
No, because nobody is investigating the conduct of the police, you know.
Yeah.
They don't care. And to be fair, it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with finding Mora.
I believe that it does.
Well, if you think he's covering up something, maybe. But if he's just a dick, it's something that should be questioned, but maybe he's just a dick. You know, does that help us find Mora? If he's just an asshole who just wanted to exonerate himself or alleviate responsibility from his troop for finding her, that's a horrible thing, and I would like that to come out, but it doesn't really necessarily mean that it would point us in a useful direction.
Here's where I think it matters. I agree that it doesn't necessarily point us in a useful direction, but I think the danger is that it points us in a very unuseful, that's not a word.
yes.
It creates misdirection.
Yeah.
So if we're wondering why it seemed plausible for someone to author a book about Mora leaving her life, packing up and heading off to Canada, well, I think that some responsibility lies in Skorinza's hands, because that whole narrative probably wouldn't have as much credibility as it, credibility, I'm using that like in air quotes, as it does if not for these kinds of statements. And this is like a page and a half, and the first half is all unnecessary information that has to do with the state of her dorm room, her personal issues with her boyfriend. One line, one single line paragraph, there was no death in the family.
She's a liar.
It paints a picture that no wonder you have people running away with these theories.
Yep.
So I think that there is a danger of misdirecting away from what actually happened. Because if there's somebody out there that might know something, but they keep hearing over and over, oh, well, no, actually she was suicidal and that's why she was heading there. Oh, no, actually she was heading to Canada. Well, maybe they're not so likely to come forward with that information if they're not entirely sure.
Right.
So I do think it matters.
Well, yeah, I certainly think it definitely could have and possibly did harm chances of finding her. And I do think it's worth setting the record straight. We've kind of already raised all these points previously, but it is good to bring it back up and put it all together, especially now that we have some additional evidence to look at. Unfortunately, you know, does it point us at a suspect? No, which is too bad. I hope the people listening and watching and trying to figure out what happened take all this into consideration when they evaluate the various theories that are still floating around, although most of them have been put down. At this point, I don't think too many people are saying she went to Canada. One good thing about the show is it did kind of smash some of those crazy ideas.
Yeah.
Not saying they're impossible, but they just look a whole lot less likely. And this is just more information that kind of verifies that.
Yes.
All right. Well, did you want to talk about the Lori list?
Oh, yeah, if we can do it quick. Just because sure. I thought this was so strange. Okay. So somebody actually posted this on Reddit several days ago, or maybe like a week ago. And it's something that I had never heard of, but in New Hampshire is called the Lori list. So I'll explain the background. There was I believe, a murder case in 1995 that ended up being reversed or overturned on appeal because it turned out that the officer that testified had credibility or honesty issues in the past. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't disclosed to the defense at the time.
Right.
So he was convicted in part on this officer's testimony, and it was overturned. So after that, they initiated this thing in New Hampshire called the Lori List, where each of the counties, I believe, the state's attorneys in each of the counties, submits a list of officers that they believe could be liability issues if they were to testify in court.
Yeah. So the reasoning behind this, it's very sensible, actually, is to protect the state from making a mistake and putting someone on the stand who later is going to cause a verdict to be invalidated. So they want to make sure, the prosecutors want to make sure they know ahead of time who might destroy their case after the fact.
Right. And I agree, it's sensible, it's practical, it's pragmatic. On the other hand, there's the obvious question that if an officer can't be trusted to testify honestly under oath, then why do we trust them with a badge and a gun to enforce the laws of the land?
Sure. And, you know, a potential answer to that is that the standard of, you know, convicting someone of murder is perhaps, you know, demands a higher level of credibility than simply patrolling the neighborhood would require. Because let's face it, most police are not going to testify in murder investigations.
Well, you could say that, but you could also say that all murder investigations will have officers testifying.
Well, this is a good question for Catherine. I do not believe that nearly all police officers testify, ever.
No. But we're both things can be true. Like, most officers don't testify in homicide investigations. However, all homicide investigations will utilize officers' testimony.
Sure. But what I'm saying is that if most officers are never going to testify, why does their credibility necessarily always matter?
Oh, I see.
As long as most officers are credible, you don't need them all to be credible in order for them to function as police officers. I would say I don't really want someone patrolling the streets who's not that credible, who's a liar, or is considered not trustworthy. But I know that realistically, look, you do need someone to provide, you know, law and order, protection for the community. Sometimes you just need warm bodies, and you can't always... I don't know. Here's the thing. There shouldn't be a shortage of qualified people, at least for state police. For towns, you know, local police departments might not be in as much demand, but I think they're pretty sought after jobs. You know, there's a lot of people who want to be police because it's a pretty nice job. You get a pension usually, decent pay. So, you know, should we be able to kind of demand that they all are credible enough to appear in court and testify in court?
I would argue yes. Yeah. But that's my personal opinion.
Yeah. And it's not like it's a huge list, right? It's 100.
150.
150. I mean, that's a pretty big list. How many police officers do you suppose there are in New Hampshire? Like, what percentage are we looking at here? A couple thousand, maybe?
Okay, so this is a list of law enforcement agencies in the state of New Hampshire. According to the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, 2008 census, state and local law enforcement agencies, the state had 208 law enforcement agencies employing 2,936 sworn police officers.
Okay, it's 5%. So that's actually a pretty healthy number. That's a pretty big percentage. If you had to replace 5% of your workforce, it's a lot of work. But, you know, they didn't all get added to the list at the same time. So
yeah, and a lot of them are former. I will say that. Former law enforcement.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, I tend to think that if you're on that list, you probably shouldn't be a cop. It's a little weird. All I can figure is, like, look, the purpose of the list was very specific. It was specifically to aid prosecutors in not messing up their cases by putting the wrong guy in the stand.
Right.
It seems irrational, but I don't think it's really that irrational.
No, I don't think it's irrational. I think, if anything, it points to the fact that even among prosecutors, they're aware there are bad apples out there don't always necessarily tell the truth.
Yeah. And if you were to ask Catherine about that, she could definitely tell you about all the problems with putting police on the stands.
But yeah, I was thinking of the Lori list in the context of Officer Smith. Mm-hmm. Because it seems like there is this belief out there that just because he says something happened, it has to be true.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know very little about him, I would say, or I know very little about him. Of the things that I do know, of the statements that he made on the oxygen show, the thing about the suicide, the squaw walk, Mr. Murray contests. He says that it didn't occur like that. He took it out of context and it wasn't what he was communicating. Atwood says the thing that Smith says about her being drunk that Atwood denies.
Or did deny.
Did deny at the time. So there are some credibility issues. Like, of the several things that I know that he said, everyone contests.
Yeah, it is contested. So, like, somebody's wrong. Somebody has credibility issues. Is it Smith? Is it Atwood? Is it Fred? You can make the case for all of them, but...
But there's only one common denominator.
Yes. So I would certainly like to know if he was on that list. And whether he is or not, the fact is, there's 150 people who are all cops.
Mm-hmm.
And which simply and very easily proves that you can't just assume that every cop is credible.
Right. Yeah. And I guess that's the basic point.
I think Art would probably counter that. Okay, but I don't have any specific reason to believe he was lying. And I'm using my instincts to suggest that he was not lying. You know, but I would say, okay, but you don't know. Why are we giving him the benefit of the doubt? I'm not giving anyone in this case the benefit of the doubt. And I'm certainly not giving someone the benefit of the doubt just because they have a badge.
Right. Especially when one other conflicting piece of information that Smith puts out there on the show that I was a little bit surprised that they didn't follow up on about was that he says that Kathleen told him when they spoke, which it was Tuesday, the following day, Tuesday, February 10th, is when he spoke to Kathleen on the phone. Mm-hmm. Smith says that Kathleen told him that she was upset that she had gotten into her father's car when she was drinking the weekend before, and that she may have taken sleeping pills and she's dead in the woods somewhere. The issue with that is that Kathleen didn't know about the accident on Tuesday. She didn't know at that point, before speaking to her father, that there even was an accident. I mean, it's quite coincidental that Smith knew the contents of the car and knew that there were sleeping pills in there. Kathleen did not. She didn't know it was in the car. Why would she assume that Maura took a bunch of sleeping pills and walked out into the woods? So, two pieces of information that Smith knew that Kathleen didn't, that he's attributing to Kathleen.
Yeah.
Now, could Kathleen be not telling the truth about that? Maybe. But it's one more data point that suggests that perhaps Smith has some credibility issues or remembers things the way that he prefers to remember them and not how they actually are.
Yeah. And if you look at what occurred with Fred and the Squaw Walk, Fred's version is that Smith was pushing him about the question of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears, if that's accurate, that Smith has retroactively retconned that to, well, he brought up Squaw Walk. And I was like, what? So very easy to see. Perhaps the same thing happened with Kathleen. He was like, where he asked her, well, you know, did she think she had some sleeping pills on her? Do you think maybe she took some sleeping pills? And she said, maybe. She said, maybe. And then he was like, ah, Kathleen said that she took some, you know, and he would think to himself, I'm not lying. She said, maybe. And that's certainly a thing that police do in interrogations, is they try to get you to say something and then they say that you said it, with leaving out the part that they led you to agree with them.
They put the image in your head to begin with. So, I mean, extend that to Atwood. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I think that this is what happened. Atwood never considered the fact that she was drinking, but Smith puts it in his head. Well, could she have been drinking? Well, yeah, she could have been drinking. And then he says, Atwood says that she was intoxicated.
Yeah.
So I guess all of this is to say that just because Smith said something was true doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah. It's just another witness statement. And we know how reliable those are.
And in light of his track record from, albeit the very limited information that we have,
it's particularly suspect.
Yeah.
More so than a random person, I would say. I think he's probably less credible than the average person would be, in spite of the fact that he's a police officer.
Right. At least with the limited information that we have, it seems like just about everyone that he speaks to contests the version of events that he presents.
Yep. I've encountered it before, and it always still surprises me. It's just like, it really is a, like, whose side are you on thing. It's like, look, these are the police. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, of course there's bad apples, but, like, ultimately, it's the police. You're either on their side or you're on the other side.
Right.
Like, why are you calling them into question? Do you want people to rise up against the police? Do you want there to be crime? Like, are you on the side of crime? Look, you're going to make the whole thing look bad just because of this one guy. Look, whose side are you on, Aaron? Are you on the side of law and order? Or are you on the side of anarchy and chaos? Is that what you want? Riots in the streets?
I just don't like the facts to get in the way of a good story, that's all. I just want my good story.